you. A warm welcome again. A warm welcome. Thanks for the applause and thanks for your interest in Apple's low latency Wi-Fi and in this talk especially about cracking open what makes Apple's low latency Wi-Fi so fast. Before we begin, let me introduce myself with a few words. So I am a researcher at OpenCritis. We publish information about German cybersecurity regulations and cybersecurity regulations in the EU. And if terms like EUNIS2 or EUCER do mean anything to you, then visiting our website might be a worthwhile thing to do. And besides that, I am a student at the Hasso-Plattner Institute, and the contents of the following talk will be about come from my master's thesis and my research at the chair of Jiska Klaassen, mobile and wireless security. So as you might know, Apple devices are highly interconnected devices. For example, if you own a Mac and an iPad, you can do things like extending your Mac's desktop to your iPad in a wireless manner, with sidecar display, for example. Or you can use your mouse and your keyboard to remote control your iPad from your Mac with universal control. You can also use your iPhone as a webcam on your Mac, or even a desk cam with continuity camera. And with iPhone mirroring, it's possible to remote control your iPhone from your Mac. And there are a bunch of different features that make up this ecosystem experience Apple built. And all these features are comprised and summarized under this umbrella term, continuity. Now, the features I just presented all share three things in common. They mostly transmit video data. They operate under real-time constraints. And they leverage this link layer protocol low latency Wi-Fi. And in the past, there have been a few questions about low latency Wi-Fi and its interface LLW0. For example, researchers have questions about how this interface is open from a system level perspective, or whether third-party devices are low latency Wi-Fi compatible. And in the end, as well, what makes low latency Wi-Fi actually low latency? Now, these questions are quite difficult to answer because there are so many traces and logs we can examine in different files and using different utilities. So for example, we can investigate the system logs. We can also investigate kernel traces with ktrace and dtrace. We can examine cross-process communication with XPC, examine backtraces, and aside from the system level perspective, we can also take a look at the packet captures on any interface possible. And because of this vast amount of information and this wide variety of utilities we can use, there has been a missing solution in the past that correlates this log information from different log sources in a timely manner, and even from different devices. Because without this solution, it's very, very difficult to correlate events that occur among different files, for example. So imagine you have several files on multiple devices. Then this solution, a log aggregator, would need to merge these files in order to facilitate research for network protocol details. And this is why the first part of this talk will be about building a log aggregator before diving into the details of low latency Wi-Fi. So let's start by building a log aggregator. There are, of course, some strings attached, some challenges. And the first one is the availability of forensic sources, especially on iOS. There are different utilities we can use, primarily on macOS, for example, the console application for viewing the system logs on Apple platforms, Wireshark, for capturing network captures, Packet Logger for capturing Bluetooth captures, CCTool. This is a utility that collects information from a separate logging framework in Apple platforms that are related to IEEE 802.11 information. And dtrace and ktrace are utilities that can collect kernel traces. So as already mentioned, these utilities are available on macOS. But before my research, it was uncertain whether dtrace, ktrace, and cctool are available on iOS. And as it turns out, there is an alternative for ktrace, which we will look at in a second. And by reverse engineering the underlying framework of cctool, which is called Core Capture Control, I was able to re-implement cctool for iOS. Concerning dtrace, we don't know yet whether that is feasible on iOS, so further research needs to be done here. Now, if you take a look at the Hack Different Discord and search for ktrace, you might end up in the general channel and find a post which talks about ktrace being available in some repository called System Commands. And you might find yourself looking this repository up on GitHub in the Apple Open Source Software Distributions organization. And you might find yourself confused because there's no trace at all of ktrace. However, as it turns out, there is a release of this repository back in 2022 that actually lists a tool called Trace. And it turns out that Trace is able to generate ktrace parsable output. And using the right build commands and the correct dependencies, especially header files from the GNU kernel, it's possible to build the Trace utility for iOS and therefore bring support for ktrace output to iOS and iPadOS devices. The second challenge is about clock offsets. Because when we talk about collecting logs from multiple devices, we also talk about devices where clocks are not perfectly aligned. And this is especially cumbersome when, and unfortunate when trying to aggregate different log files, because without aligning the clocks, the aggregated log file will end up being misaligned. So the solution here is, of course, to collect the clock offsets and compute them during log collection so that we can account later on during the log aggregation for the clock offsets. And I did that by implementing an NTP client and an NTP server that can communicate wirelessly or even through a simple Lightning cable or USB-C cable and using iProxy. The collection on multiple devices of forensic sources is a second or third problem, because before we can aggregate logs, we need, of course, collect the logs. And manually initiating these tools is quite cumbersome, because when you look at this table, there are at least 11 tools we would need to initiate manually. So the solution here is, of course, to automate this. And I did that by implementing a small toolkit consisting of several shell scripts. This toolkit is invoked from macOS and is essentially just a command line interface where the macOS device can instruct the iPad via an SSH tunnel to initiate, start, and stop certain commands. And basically, this toolkit is about process management and also about transferring files between both devices. And in the end, there are essentially two scripts running on both devices simultaneously that initiate the tools that collect log sources. So you can connect your iPad or iOS device to your Mac The script then starts the captures, network captures, for example, with T-Shark and TCP dump. Then you can run your network protocol or continuity feature or whatever you like. Afterwards, the script will collect more information, especially log information from the system logs, transfer the files back to the Mac, and then the toolkit will run the log aggregation, which is, of course, a problem on its own because we have to deal with varying file formats. There's JSON data involved with console and ktrace, for example. There are pkip and g files in the output of cctool and Wireshark, and even custom output with dtrace. So the solution here is to build file-specific parsers, parsers that parse the information in these files into custom business logic. And once we have this information in business logic, basically in objects, Python objects, for example, we need, of course, filter some irrelevant data out because there is a lot going on we are not interested in. And finally, the log aggregator will write data into either a pkip and g file or a log archive file. As already hinted at, noise filtering is also a challenge. So as you might imagine, in an operating system, there is a lot of boring stuff going on, a lot of regular stuff, a lot of stuff we are not interested in. And the idea here is to record these traces and store them in a file so that it contains data that acts as reference for noise data. And then we can go ahead and record traces from the protocol we are interested in, for example, sidecar display, which of course holds the fun traces, the traces we are interested in, the traces that are low latency Wi-Fi related. And then using this noise reference data and comparing it to the traces of sidecar display in this example, we can filter out the boring stuff, the stuff we are not interested in. And on a technical level, this happens based on hash values. The log aggregator also supports static filters so that you can define whitelist and blacklist filters and filter out log lines based on process names. So in this example, the aggregated log file won't contain any log lines from a process called Electron, for example. So building a log aggregator in the end involved developing multi-device support. The log aggregator supports multiple input formats and is basically extensible to any tracing utility you can invoke on the command line. It supports log archive and pkip and g file output, accounts for clock offsets, and also for noise filtering. So let's move on to investigating the network stack on macOS and iOS. The network stack on macOS and iOS, and essentially on any Apple platform, consists of multiple system components. So starting in the user space, there are a variety of system daemons. In the case of sidecar display, for example, the AV conference daemon and the Wi-Fi peer-to-peer daemon. And these system daemons call into a data structure called the DYLD shared cache. This data structure holds frameworks and libraries that system daemons need to function properly. And these frameworks, in the end, call into kernel space. And the kernel space is comprised of, well, the kernel binary, but also kernel extensions, which are other MAHO binaries. And these kernel extensions are specialized for different tasks, like networking-related tasks, time management, communicating with co-processors, et cetera. And as it turns out, in the past, in the last few years, Apple moved some of this networking-related kernel part and some networking-related kernel extensions into user space, into a second DYLD shared cache, which is called the driver kit shared cache. And because this second DYLD shared cache wasn't documented thoroughly before this talk, actually, here's a slide that covers some of these frameworks in more detail. So for example, the driver Apple Broadcom WLAN is a user space process which re-implements the Apple Broadcom WLAN core kernel extension and manages interfaces, queues, and configures wireless chips. Then another important framework will be the networking driver kit. This is actually a public framework, and it is used for providing foundational functions to communicate with networking drivers. And there's also the IO 802.11 driver kit that handles IEEE 802.11 concepts and states, and it substitutes the former kernel extension IO 802.11 family. There are also other private frameworks in the driver kit shared cache, which are apparently empty. It's not clear why that is. Maybe Apple forgot about developing these frameworks. Maybe they postponed development. That's unsure so far. But basically, these are the system components we need to examine in order to get an idea of what is going on in the network stack on Apple platforms. We have user space processes. We have the DYLD shared cache that contains certain frameworks, system calls, kernel extensions, and a variety of driver kit components. So in order to investigate low latency Wi-Fi, we can, from a system level perspective, take a look at how macOS, for example, manages its interface low latency Wi-Fi 0, LLW 0. And at first, this interface needs to be activated, of course. In user space, this is done by the AV conference daemon that calls into the networking framework, which then calls a system call called channel open. And the flow of execution goes through the kernel into the kernel extension IO Skywalk family, which is a kernel extension responsible for networking related tasks. And as you can see, this kernel extension calls a function called set interface enable. And the IO Skywalk family calls into this driver kit component, comApple driver kit Apple Broadcom WLAN. And in the end, enabling this interface is basically attaching a Berkeley packet filter. So providing a memory region for the AV conference daemon to transmit data via the LLW0 interface and receive data from it. Low latency Wi-Fi is also configured by a second user space daemon, which is called the Wi-Fi peer-to-peer daemon. And presumably, this daemon calls into the Wi-Fi peer-to-peer framework, presumably then calls into the kernel and into the IO Skywalk family, which in turn presumably calls into the driver kit domain. I'm saying presumably because Grand Central Dispatch is involved here, and Grand Central Dispatch is responsible for asynchronous function calling. So tracing the system and function call is not very easy. However, most interestingly here is that the IO 802.11 driver kit calls a function which is called configure HPP low latency Wi-Fi parameters. And this function is used by basically any sidecar, any low latency Wi-Fi related continuity feature we investigated. So this function is used by sidecar display, universal control, iPhone mirroring, AirPlay to Mac, which is used when you mirror your iPad screen, for example, to your Mac, and Apple Watch mirroring, which is basically iPhone mirroring, but for the Apple Watch on iOS. And this function calls another function, default VO low latency Wi-Fi parameters, that obviously, based on the name, provides static parameters for low latency Wi-Fi. And these static parameters are passed to this function called set low latency Wi-Fi parameters. And before turning to these parameters, let's first investigate how the data transmission is done using LLW0. So the AV conference daemon calls again into the network framework, which calls into the kernel space by using a system call called channel sync. And the flow of execution goes again into the IO Skywalk family. And as it turns out, the IO Skywalk family uses data structures that hint at submission queues. Submission queues and completion queues are used in NVMe for communication with coprocessors. So we can assume that the IO Skywalk family is responsible for communicating the kernel packets that are to be sent over the network with a wireless chip. And in the end, the IO Skywalk family informs probably the wireless chip that data is available to be sent. After transmission, the driver kit shared cache and the networking driver kit gets informed that some packets have been transmitted. And the networking driver kit calls into kernel space to inform the kernel about which packets can now be freed from memory. So in the end, the system components involved in data transmission with low latency Wi-Fi reside both in user space and in kernel space. In user space, the system daemons, AV conference daemon, and Wi-Fi peer-to-peer daemon are involved. We figured out that some parts of the kernel space of the networking stack moved into user space, into a second DYLD shared cache, which is called the driver kit shared cache. And other concepts are at play here. For example, NVMe, Berkeley packet filters, and system calls like channel open and channel sync. So let's continue with investigating the low latency property of LLW. As a quick reminder, when we talk about low latency Wi-Fi, we are talking about the network access layer in the TCP/IP stack, or in the OSI ISO model, about the link layer and the physical layer. On the link layer, therefore, we can look into standards like the IEEE 802.11 standard. And as it turns out, low latency Wi-Fi leverages concepts that are defined in these standards, and in particular in the amendments E, N, and AC. The E amendment defines concepts for quality of service, and the N amendment defines concepts on high throughput. And we are going to cover some of these concepts in order to understand what low latency Wi-Fi is doing in order to achieve low latency. In the E amendment, there is something called the enhanced distributed channel access. The EDCA categorizes network traffic into four different access categories. And from background to voice, they all feature different priorities for medium access and channel access. And low latency Wi-Fi uses and classifies its traffic in the access category voice, also for video traffic. So if you use sidecar display, for example, or iPhone mirroring, you are probably transmitting, or your device is probably transmitting data in the access category voice. Now, to understand how this arbitration in priority for medium access is achieved, we need to consider how devices access the medium. So suppose the medium has been busy because network devices have been sending data, then devices with very high priority control frames get to send first, after waiting for a short interframe spacing. However, if no such network devices are available, then devices that have EDCA classified network traffic available in the queues are, well, next to send. And as you can see, there's an arbitration interframe spacing for the access category voice and video that is shorter than the arbitration interframe spacing for network traffic classified as best effort, for example, or background. And to prohibit network devices from transmitting simultaneously, there is a second concept involved here before transmitting data, which is called the random backoff period. So before devices start sending data, they initiate a random backoff counter. And to visualize that, I have this little figure here. So suppose the medium is idle. Multiple devices have data available to be sent. And suppose multiple devices decide simultaneously now to just send data because they don't initiate any random backoff timer. Then this causes some trouble on the medium, because in a wireless scenario, sending data is always louder than receiving data. So while sending, you can't hear and detect collisions in a wireless scenario. So this is why there is the concept of random backoff counters, where devices choose a random integer between the interval from 0 to a variable called CWmin. And this variable is different for each access category. So suppose there are two devices picking a random backoff count, and the smartphone down here picks the integer 1, then this device gets to send first, and therefore wins access to the medium. And transmission can happen without any collisions. And after the random backoff period during transmission, there are different transmission opportunity values for each access category. And video traffic, for example, gets to send for the longest duration, while audio traffic and best effort and background traffic have shorter transmission opportunities. Now recall this function called default VO low latency Wi-Fi parameters. This function provides different configuration values for low latency Wi-Fi. And as it turns out, the IEEE 802.11 specification is coherent with the parameters defined by the default VO low latency Wi-Fi parameters function. And actually, this function and the parameters defined in it precisely match the ones defined in 802.11 until 2012. There's also a second function called default low latency Wi-Fi parameters. And as it turns out, this function completely skips the initial contention window and a random backoff period, so that devices can send right after the arbitration interframe spacing elapses. And this function also defines a transmission opportunity that exceeds the value defined in 802.11 by far. So with default LLW parameters, devices can send up to 8 milliseconds. As a disclaimer, we did not observe this function being used in a real-world scenario, but it's still defined in the source code, so this function might be used somewhere. The N amendment introduces another concept called aggregated MPDU, and this concept allows multiple MAC layer protocol data units to be aggregated in a single physical layer data frame. And there's another concept called AMSDU, where multiple payload data can be put into a single MAC layer frame, so that on the MAC layer, there are less MAC headers, less physical headers, and less interframe spacings. And this, in turn, also saves acknowledgement frames, for example. And in turn, the gains here are, of course, for lower latency. When looking at the device tree in macOS, we can see that low latency Wi-Fi has some special configuration parameters for LLW0. And as it turns out, there is the channel bandwidth property, which translates into 80 megahertz channel bandwidth. So this bandwidth is defined in the AC amendment of IEEE 802.11, which defines specifications for radios with very high throughput. And in this particular example, the channel was configured to the channel 52, operating on a frequency of 5260 megahertz. There are also hardware capabilities involved on the MAC layer. So if you look up the IO 802.11 driver kit and look up for the term SDB or RSDB, then you will find references to some functions called real simultaneous dual band. RSDB enables devices to establish two separate links on the MAC layer, or on the link layer. So devices can establish a link to an access point, for example, while establishing also a second link for a peer-to-peer communication. And as it turns out, the kernel cache on a Mac Mini with M4 running macOS Sequoia contains references to Broadcom firmware of Broadcom chips that all feature RSDB. So it is very likely that macOS devices and iOS devices use RSDB for transmission on the link layer. And RSDB is not only a thing for Mac devices and Apple devices, but also for Android devices, for example. So in the end, low-latency Wi-Fi achieves its low-latency characteristic by labeling its traffic in the access category voice with special parameters from different amendments, especially the EDCA parameter set of the E amendment for fast channel access. It introduces, or it leverages concepts like AMSDU and AMPDU, and operates on a channel bandwidth of 80 megahertz. And hardware capabilities are also involved with RSDB. So to wrap this up, why actually bother? Why is reverse engineering low-latency Wi-Fi relevant? Well, because this is a matter of interoperability. As we have seen, interoperability should be technically feasible, because it is basically an open standard that is being implemented here, and hardware capabilities present in low-latency Wi-Fi are also available, for example, in the Android world. So Apple is basically implementing an open standard here, but seemingly reserves it for proprietary features, because there doesn't seem to be any documentation on using low-latency Wi-Fi and interacting with it from a user space perspective. In the past, there have been multiple re-implementations of several features in the Apple ecosystem. So for example, OpenDrop once re-implemented and open-sourced AirDrop. WatchWitch brought Apple Watch support on Android. OpenHaystack open-sourced the Find My network. And there are a bunch of features that rely on low-latency Wi-Fi, but which have not been reverse-engineered yet. And maybe we will see some of these features being re-implemented in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Henry, for this insightful talk. We have a few minutes left for questions. Please find your way to the microphones if you have questions. Number one, please.
Hi. Thank you for the great presentation. Yeah. In one of your slides, you showed that the NVMe is also involved when we send data via this network. I just want to understand also that you showed that there is a priority that whether voice data would be sent first or video data would be sent first. So there might be some in-memory buffer or the data might be saved in the NVMe for a part.
Yes.
But the issue is that if you write for every display that I want to share with my phone or from an Apple TV to my desktop, if I keep writing to the NVMe, it has a write cycle, so it will wear out. So do you think that for everything that they share, there is an NVMe write or read that happens? Or they save these packets in some memory buffers before they get
short questions, please.
Yes.
And could the audience please keep the noise level down for the answer? Thank you.
Yes, that is probably happening. I haven't looked into NVMe too much, and haven't considered this specific scenario yet. So, I guess further research needs to be done here. Yeah, thank you.
One question from the Signal Angel, please.
Is this on? Okay. The internet would like to know whether it's possible to sniff the decryption from end to end.
Whether it's encrypted from end to end, yes, it is. Sidecar Place, for example, uses SRTP on the application layer. Yeah.
Number three, please.
Hi. Does it have any control mechanisms like AWDL, which had the synchronization mechanism? Does it have something like that? And did you look at it?
Synchronization in what sense? Like time synchronization or?
Like AWDL did the channel hopping, but...
Yes. So there's a channel sequence, and I guess it's the same as AWDL.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Sadly, we're in a tight schedule, so we won't be able to take more questions now. Is there a place where people can find you after this talk to ask you a few more questions?
Well, probably at the Platypony's.
Where?
Platypony's in Hall H. So okay. You can look at that on C3 NAV. But I will also stay in this room just after this talk, so you can talk to me.
Sadly, we have the yearly review right after, so it's going to get really busy. Can I please have another very warm round of applause for Henry?